This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Richard Adie. Welcome to The Roundtable. Well, there's been gaffes and gotcha moments, sniping and scare campaigns, and finally, some actual policy talk. The election campaign of 2022 is well and truly underway. The first leaders' debate in Brisbane last week saw Scott Morrison and Anthony Albanese spruik their party platforms in detail in a campaign that had arguably been more about personality up until that point. Now Anthony Albanese has COVID and is in isolation. So what's the rest of the lead up to the election set to look like? What's lacking? What's lackluster? And what's likely to stick? I'm joined by three people who've spent decades covering election campaigns. Barry Cassidy, former host of the ABC's Insiders program, Nikki Sava, author and political commentator with The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, and Greg Sheridan, the foreign editor at The Australian. Welcome to you all.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Greg, I want to begin with you. I want to go first to overall views of the campaign so far. And Greg, you, in a recent article, described this one as low rent and a spectacular illustration of the decline of our political culture reduced to just a handful of considerations. You're not impressed, fair to say?
No, indeed. And great to be with you and to join my esteemed colleagues, Nikki and Sava, both of whom I've known for several thousand years. I think it's been a very low-rent campaign where the great policy challenges facing Australia simply not being mentioned. This huge structural deficit we've baked into the budget, which is going to increase from here to eternity. The absolutely dismal productivity performance in our economy, the dismal performance of our economy except for commodities, generally the persistent very, very low scores we have in international comparisons of education standards, instead of which both sides have simply taken the view that they can spend any amount of money, and their predominant rhetorical efforts are aimed at blackening the character of two people who I think are perfectly decent human beings, Scott Morrison and Anthony Albanese. Now, I think the Solomons business has injected substance into the debate, but it's been a deus ex machina kind of event. It's nothing organic within the debate itself.
We'll come to the Solomons a bit later, but Nikki, you've written that both Mr. Albanese and Mr. Morrison have been making mistakes in this campaign, but the Prime Ministers have been overlooked. Why do you say that?
Well, we had absolutely saturation coverage in that first week on Albanese's bloopers. And look, he did make a mistake. He should have known the answers to those questions on unemployment and interest rates. They're just basic facts that should be at your fingertips, right? And he had a brain snap and couldn't do it. But it wasn't just a 24-hour wonder. It went for days and days and days and days.
Yes.
And partly also because after that happened, Albanese went into a bit of a spiral. You know, his confidence was absolutely shattered, I think, and he made a mistake on costings and then got himself tangled up on boats. So it was legitimate, I think, to cover those things, but seriously, I think people by the end of it were just sick of hearing about Albo's gaffes every single night and day and, you know, right throughout the day. Whereas there were actually things that Morrison did that week of substance, which went to the substance of things, you know, not of the magnitude that Greg was talking about before, and he was quite right about what he said about the issues that aren't being debated. But he tried to inject these other things into the conversation, into the debate during a campaign, which shouldn't be there. And the main one, I think, there was the issue of transgender women in sport. I mean, that was a whole other thing of great sensitivity which needed quite delicate handling, and he was obviously keen to get it out there and have it debated regardless of the consequences. And I thought that didn't receive initially the coverage that it should. It did later because Matt Keen got out there and took it up, and then it took off.
I'm going to come back to that, but I want to bring Barry in. Barry, this is the first federal election in a long time where you've not been professionally involved, most recently as host of Insiders, but you've been commenting from the sidelines on Twitter. What is your view of how it's all been going?
Well, professionally involved as a commentator on RN.
My apologies, go on.
I think this campaign is very much like so many others before it. It's facile, it's largely unhelpful. It goes off too easily on trivial distractions. But here's the point, though, and I think that you can ask how you think a campaign is going, but there's a much bigger question. It's not how a campaign is going, but what do you think of the government performance over the last 3 years? That's what determines elections, not campaigns. Now, of course, campaigns can be affected by that performance. You can only run a strong campaign if you've got something to work with. It cuts both ways. They're judging mainly the performance of the government over 3 years, but the opposition as well. But just on the gaffe too in that first day of the campaign. And Nikki, I think, put it very well, and it did hurt. And it hurt because it went to economic competence, which is something that where Labor is trying to catch up, certainly perception-wise, with the government. But there was so much hysteria around it. Like people were saying, this is the moment where Albanese lost the election. You know, it was kind of, can he recover? You know, it's...
In a six-week campaign moment, on day one, basically.
Yeah. One moment in an election campaign would have to be pretty catastrophic to wipe out climate change, integrity, leadership, the value of local candidates. So it was significant. But I'll just give you one quick example. I've just spent the last 5 days in West Australia. They had a really interesting poll in the West Australian, I think, on Friday. 1,240 voters, so that's quite significant. One question in particular: who would be better for the economy? Well, what would be better for the economy, the election of a Morrison government or the election of an Albanese government? On the economy, 46% Morrison, 54% Albanese. And more broadly, the least desired outcome, hung parliament and coalition both on 39, Labor majority 22, that's the least desired. So there's something going on when you get to that stage on economic management. Albanese has made this mistake on day one, and you get a result like that in Australia. So I think you can exaggerate the impact of that.
Greg, only one more on the gaffe, because I really think it wouldn't be possible to say anything else about it that hasn't been said. With these reams of reporting, how much do you think this sort of went into not just the media loop, but the social media loop as well?
Well, that's right. So, look, I absolutely agree with everything Nikki and Barry have said, and they're such smart election analysts. I'd ask this question. So why did everyone get so obsessed with the gaffe? One reason is that often a particular moment or a particular image will cut through to voters, especially in the social media age. And this can be quite trivial and inherently quite trivial thing, like the pundits all say, so I presume it's true, that the handshake where Mark Latham looked aggressive with John Howard, it just looked a bit icky personally, as if Latham was trying to monster a much older, much smaller man, physically smaller, and that became, if not critically important in itself, at least tremendously emblematic. And as a result, I think we're all trained to try to look for this this special moment which is going to go viral and symbolise everything and contain everything. And that in itself is part of the problem, that sort of we're not actually really so focused on dull things. I mean, my colleague Paul Kelly said the other day, what's a $40 billion expansion of the NDIS funding up against an allegedly insensitive comment by Scott Morrison. Well, you know, so we're trained to look for this sort of telling moment.
I'm kind of wondering about that, the sort of grammar of how we do things, especially how political journalists cover things, because I wonder if part of the motivation, Nikki, to ask the gotchas comes from the fact that elections are these now incredibly choreographed, managed affairs, and what a gaffe gives you, a mistake from a gotcha, is an off-script moment, a kind of headline, a grab, something that basically the campaigns haven't controlled.
I think there is a bit of that in it. Some of the questions are entirely legitimate. I think some of them are just sheer exhibitionism by the journos.
Performative.
You know, look at me, look at me. Some are quite clearly engineered for a purpose. And you can't deny that there is rat packing going on. And also, you know, it's not beyond each side to feed in questions to journos while an opponent's press conference is going. Mm. And these days with mobiles and text messages and 24-hour news channels running everything, everybody watches and everybody, you know, wants to engineer an outcome or trigger something. So I think there is a bit of that going on. You're right about everything is so controlled. One of those controlled events and days happened yesterday, and the Prime Minister refused to front the media yesterday to answer questions. And I deliberately watched almost every news channel last night to see how that would be treated. And guess what? It barely rated a mention. Richard Marles getting caught out by yet more tricky questions featured very prominently. Okay, Marles is a poor performer, so that was probably warranted. The other main item was John Howard stepping into the campaign to try and save Bennelong.
Yeah.
Mentioned in passing was the fact that the Prime Minister refused to front to answer questions on an issue that is supposed to be one of his strong suits. And my worry is that if you allow a Prime Minister to get away with that on one day during a campaign, then he will do it again and again and again. And who misses out? The voters and the media. I thought it was supine on their part not to make a big issue of it and not to actually try to front him on it. And then to just run the pictures that he wanted, he ends up controlling everything and they become peripheral.
Barry, I want to come to you on that because I've been struck by it too, and I'm not a political journalist. I'm engaged by it, but it seems to me that Mr. Morrison is very good at framing things in a way that then the media takes up, much better at that than Labor.
I think he is, and just on that point that Mickey mentioned, I think the way that it used to work when the gallery was a much smaller operation is that there were gallery leaders like Nikki and Michelle Grattan and Laurie Oakes and others, and if they were irritated by something that was happening, by a strategy that they thought was against the public interest, they would collectively get together and put a stop to it and make it a real issue. And that's not happening now. I think there's most of the senior journalists now don't travel, and I can understand why not, because it's very expensive just to get one question in at a doorstop.
Mm.
But the most irritating aspect, I think, the doorstops themselves, and I don't blame the media for the way that they handle these things, but they are designed so that each journalist gets a question each. There's no follow-up, and so the Prime Minister constantly does this. He you can put the most perfectly framed and logical question to him, and he'll just say, I don't agree with your analysis.
Don't accept the premise of the question, Barry. Yes.
Don't accept the premise and no attempt to go to the substance of it or what is being alleged. And then it moves on to the next journalist's question and that journalist's agenda and that person's special interest. And so There's no real examination. At least, you know, a few elections back, the leaders would occasionally take the journalists to a room and have a proper news conference where you get much better discourse. And these doorstops are just they're totally stacked in favour of the politician.
Greg, we know there's an issue with media coverage focusing on leaders and their personalities rather than the policies. I know this is something that you care a lot about. Has the leaders' debate changed things? Or between the debates, will campaigning go back to that kind of more presidential style that we've come to expect?
No, I think the campaigning has been superficial and image focused, and I think the media has just had to sort of had to cop it. And as Nikki points out, sometimes the media is complicit in it. I thought the leaders' debate was very useful for exactly the point that Barry makes. At least it goes for a longer time. I wish we had more leaders' debates, and I wish they went for an hour and a half each. I ran my own little personal campaign this last week to make sure that Maurice Payne and Penny Wong have a debate. I mean, we're in this justifiable national nervous breakdown over what's happening with China and the Solomons, and yet, as of a week ago, there were no plans for the foreign minister and the shadow foreign minister to have a debate. Now, of course, it's the truth that most voters don't watch the debates, but still they are democratically available if they're on free-to-air TV and if they're on websites for free and so forth. And the thing goes for an hour or preferably an hour and a half. I mean, I think Donald Trump ruined the debates in America, but before Trump, the presidential and vice presidential debates in America were very substantial. And candidates were subject to follow-up questions, and millions, tens of millions of Americans watched them, and I think that does get you better better substance. So you can't be absurd about this. Of course, you know, they're not university professors giving alternative lectures, and you don't mind lots of image and gimmicks and so on, but you do want the substance there as well.
Well, I mean, of course, traditionally the American presidential candidates have one, and the VP candidates have one as well. Given that you organised Maurice Payne and Penny Wong to talk to each other in public, is there a case for perhaps more of the ministers and their shadows to have a contest of ideas in front of us?
I think there is, myself personally. I would like every senior portfolio to routinely be subject. I know the National Press Club tries to organise this. The Agriculture Minister and his shadow had a debate the other day, and I found it quite enlightening. There were things I learned about it, things I learned where, you know, the government is not going to live up to the policies it's pronounced in the past, or where the opposition is obfuscating an issue. I mean, you can't hide in a longer debate. And I wish every senior portfolio in the government had a debate between the minister and the shadow minister. I'd love it if it went for 90 minutes at the press club. They make opening statements and then be subject to questions.
This is the Roundtable on Sunday Extra, and today we're talking about the media's coverage of the election. We've got Greg Sheridan from The Australian and Barry Cassidy, of course, who you know from Insiders, and Nikki Sava. Barry, I think you wanted to add something there.
Just on the debates. I wish they were debates, but they're not. They're dual news conferences. And there should be more of an opportunity for the two leaders to engage one another. I mean, Nikki, I'm sure you remember those debates with Bob Hawke and Andrew Peacock. I remember the toing and froing went on the whole time because it was built into the system that the other leader could have a response to some of the questions. And then that just led to a bit of general discussion. Then they're forced to go off script, and you really do get a test of their mettle. And it's just a shame that the format is the way it is.
Well, can I add something there too?
Yeah,
I watched the debate, obviously, on Sky the other night, and unlike others who might have been bored, I actually found it fascinating, and more so because of the questions that were being asked of the two politicians, not necessarily their answers, although they were, you know, indicative too. But I found it interesting that in a room full of swinging voters, and I was assured later by Sky that they had been very carefully selected from you know, cross-section of southeast Queensland, that there were three questions that were asked that night that went to integrity and the general disillusionment of people with the system and with politicians. There were no questions on climate change. There were no questions on transgender in sport. There was only one question really on cost of living, that was housing affordability. And then there was the NDIS question, obviously. But, you know, these were the things that were obviously playing on the minds of people, and they got an opportunity to put them to the leaders. And I thought that that was a very good thing. But I also agree with Barry that they need to have that interaction as well, which means there should be more debates. And they haven't been able to agree so far on another debate. And I think that is appalling. And that's another thing that we should be exercised about, that they think that they can go through an entire election campaign with only one debate. I don't think that's on.
That they can get away with going through a campaign with only one debate, in fact. I want to ask you something, Greg, that struck me in the week, because Nikki mentioned the questions about integrity, and indeed the Integrity Commission, which of course has been this vexed issue for the government. And yet we had a story, I think, in the Nine newspapers where coalition MPs were all saying this is not an issue. So yet we also hear again and again that it is an issue. And I think a lot of people said, well, the media's jumped on this because they've been spoon-fed it by the combination of the PMO talking to backbenchers and these backbenchers then ringing up the reporter. What did you make of it?
Well, I think it would be difficult to have handled an issue worse than the way the government has handled the Integrity Commission. Again, I don't want to, slavishly quote my colleague Paul Kelly, but I do think there he makes a very strong case that the actual utility of these commissions is pretty limited, and you can get a lot of weird results out of the commission, and which don't necessarily buttress integrity. But if that's the government's view, then the government ought to put that view, that we don't need an integrity commission. And if but the government's formal view is that we do need an integrity commission, but it wasn't game to put its own legislation into the House, and now it promises that it's going to do so in the future. Now, I'm not advocating a vote for either side here, but I think the government, and this reflects the reality of modern politics, is infinitely more comfortable at performative symbolism and big announcements, and particularly in an area that I am obsessively concerned with, defence. The government takes refuge in a foreign country called the distant future. So it ends, you know, it can make an announcement of a squillion dollars, you know, tens of billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars, because none of it is going to happen for 10 or 20 years, and they're quite confident that the voters will completely have forgotten whatever any government commitment it made. Now, but I think this reaches its use-by date, this kind of approach, where everything is... So even on this transgender issue, you make a big song and dance around election time in order to mobilise voters who have views on this matter, and then you do nothing about it in government. Not that I'm suggesting they should do something about that specific issue, but I think the one thing that does reinforce cynicism amongst voters is that you get from both sides of politics these symbolic gestures and announcements which are then not followed up. And certainly the promise to introduce an integrity commission, if the government thinks an integrity commission is potentially more harmful than beneficial, they ought to make that case. If, on the other hand, they think they have a model that works, then they should have put the legislation into the parliament. You can't dance both sides of the street indefinitely without inducing even greater cynicism.
Barry, I want to come back to you because you mentioned you're in WA and Scott Morrison was there, I think, too. What has the media coverage been like over there?
Amusing, to say the least. The day before, or the morning that Scott Morrison was to arrive in the West, in Perth, The West Australian had a big banner headline. They had a photograph of Scott Morrison on a plane with his head down taking copious notes, right? And the headline was, Morrison arrives with his five-year plan for Perth or something. And then the next day we were told he was creating 5,000 jobs and was all very good. Then on the third day, and I just suddenly discovered the West Australian's vulnerability. It's patriotism, or it's sort of... That because on the third day, Albanese had announced that they were going to have their campaign launch in Perth. The front page was a graphic of a map of Western Australia with the planets running off them, and the headline was Western Australia, the centre of the universe. And so suddenly, because they're having this campaign, they got all excited, and the story was basically, see, Western Australia does matter. So I think that was quite a strategic win for the Labor Party because, look, let's face it, you have it in West Australia, you have the campaign launch in Brisbane or Sydney or Melbourne, you know, they don't really care that much. It really matters in Perth, and so I think they're on a bit of a winner there.
Nikki, I'm wondering, because of something that Barry and I think all of you have alluded to earlier, which is that there's the campaign, but really what we should be deciding on is this government's last 3 years. How important do you think the media's coverage, the way the media frames both sides in the election, is in terms of affecting its result?
Well, you have to look at a government's record, right, when they're coming up for re-election and ask yourself, or the media should be asking, what does this mean about what happens next? And will they behave any differently in the next term than they have behaved in this term? I think Greg was quite right before when he, talked about he didn't put it in these terms, but I will. They make a great show of announcing something and then there's no follow-up. That is what happened with the Integrity Commission, as he pointed out. It also happened with religious freedom, by the way. Nothing happened with that for 3 years. Then there was, this sort of token effort at the end to clean something up, and that went nowhere too. I think, there has to be more attention paid to what the government has actually achieved and how they achieved it, and whether this gives us any confidence that they will do better in the next 3 years if they get another 3 years. I mean, Morrison today, apparently, it's been fed out to the Sunday papers, is going to make a pledge that he will not increase taxes. Wow. I mean... What does that mean for, any program to reform taxes in Australia, which hasn't been done for 20 years since we introduced the GST? What does it mean about debt and deficit reduction? Probably nothing. So, and what does it mean generally for an economic reform agenda? Well, there isn't one. So we have this pledge that grabs a headline, no new taxes, but what is the substance behind that? And I look forward to seeing and reading if there is any, but I doubt very much that there will be. It just sounds like another slogan to me.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we have time for. Thanks to Nikki Sava, author and political commentator with The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, Barry Cassidy, former host of the ABC's Insiders program, and Greg Sheridan, the foreign editor at The Australian. I'm Richard Aidy. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.